Hello, I'm Richard Kilgariff, and welcome to the Bokomi podcast. We're getting smarter, faster together with original, memorable insights, or OMI, from the most wanted minds across business, science, technology, and culture.
I'm Flynn Coleman, author of A Human Algorithm, and this is my OMI for Bokomi.
In this episode, we meet the international human rights advocate who wants us to look at artificial intelligence through a moral lens, or perhaps a kaleidoscope of different opinions so that we can all partner with robots rather than fight them for unilateral control.
And so I think that there is, and it's only natural, to have a deep fear of what AI is going to take from us. And part of why I think AI is such an interesting, difficult topic is that for the first time, suddenly we're wondering if we're still going to be at the top of the food chain.
Flynn Coleman works with the UN and governments to improve social justice around the world. She sees the best and the worst of people at work in a diverse range of societies and cultures. She describes in her first book, A Human Algorithm, how artificial intelligence is defining who we are, a cautious statement of hope that technology will help us define who we really are as a species. Flynn, welcome to Bokomi.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here.
It's nice, isn't it? It's nice and hot here. Got a little bit of bead of sweat across my top lip. It's very attractive. Thought you'd like me to describe that to you. Knowing what you know, who do you think we really are as humans, given that all the current threats to civilization currently are circling the planet? Haven't we shown ourselves to be lacking a moral code or any agreed set of values?
I think that that is certainly a question at the top of everyone's mind. And in a sense, it's one of the most ancient questions about who we are as a species. And I get asked that question a lot because ultimately my book strikes a hopeful tone and is optimistic. And I always say that I think it's actually a rebellion to be optimistic in these troubled times. And I actually think we can't afford not to be. And as a human rights lawyer who has been a war crimes lawyer and has worked on genocide and issues of crimes against humanity my entire career. Of course, I've seen the worst in humanity, but it also actually means I've seen the best, the courage, the resilience, the bravery, the ability to kind of rise up beyond all the suffering and the pain. So the answer to that is we are all of that. And we are imperfect and messy and majestic and brilliant and incredibly flawed. And I do think that making room for all parts of ourselves and facing that is incredibly critical in terms of moving forward with all our weaknesses and limitations, but also our strengths and our ability collectively to rise above all of the things that are going on.
Well, you quote Walt Whitman towards the end of the book saying, we are large and we contain multitudes. And that's definitely a philosophy and an emotion that runs through the book, all the way through the book, that sense of embracing what it is to be human. So talking about artificial intelligence, when did we start, when did we as a global culture, when did we start getting interested in artificial intelligence? Who coined the term and how has it changed over the years?
Indeed, a really interesting question and part of why I'm drawn to the fascinating idea of artificial intelligence is for me, it really is a mirror for who we are. And there's lots of different answers to that question. But one is that in the 1950s at a Dartmouth conference, the term was coined. And of course, as many of us will be well familiar with, and I devote some time to him in the book, is Alan Turing as well, was thinking about artificial intelligence. So the idea and the term was actually there long before we had any of the tools to really start realizing some of these ideas. And of course, I go through a lot of those stories from Alan Turing to Ada Lovelace to all of the ways that we were thinking about this idea of thinking machines before we had the tools to create them. And part of why we're at a bit of a crossroads now is that we're actually starting to build the technological tools that could help us realize what artificial intelligence means. And the other thing is, I actually think that it's possible the term artificial intelligence will fall by the wayside at a certain point. And virtual intelligence, synthetic intelligence, digital intelligence, augmented intelligence are other ways of thinking about this idea. And it also encompasses many different things. So the world of artificial intelligence has a lot of different theories, a lot of different people that are building it in different ways. So kind of the future remains to be seen as to what this will look like in the future. But the idea of artificial intelligence has been around for a while. And fellow sci-fi nerds will be very pleased with the book as well, because I dive into a lot of the literature and film and ways that we've thought about AI from all facets, because it really does encompass so many different things.
Certainly do dive and dip and dive into literature and science fiction in particular, and sci-fi nerds. And science fiction as a genre has always attempted to imagine the future, hasn't it? But sometimes we need to look to the past to understand where we're going. So why do you think AI technology is any different to previous disruptive technologies like the steam engine or the printing press? Surely we just use the technology that comes along and carry on as societies.
Yes, you know, as we had discussed the history chapter, when I go through the history of technology and specifically information and communication technologies, really seems to be something that people are drawn to because it's a way to think about the relationship between humanity, and the tools and technologies we've created. So one of the things that I always, you know, say to my students or when I'm speaking to people is that technology, of course, when we think about technology now, we think about AI or nuclear technology or bioengineering, but fire is technology. So is irrigation or celestial navigation. And so I do think that looking back through history, it serves as a guide. We can see patterns and cues for how we've related to our tools in the past. And I think on the one hand, AI is incredibly different because it is a technology that could allow an exponential increase in terms of what we're able to do scientifically. At the same time, I think that tools are a mirror for who we are as a society and where we are. We see things in the historical record like the human hand evolved alongside language and evolved alongside who we are. So we've always been using these types of tools to work alongside of. The difference now with AI is that the hockey stick growth, the acceleration of technology is so fast. So for example, with the Industrial Revolution, we had about 40 years to assimilate to all the changes brought about by the steam engine, the complex layer of things that happened to create the Industrial Revolution. Now we're not gonna have nearly as much time to assimilate to what's happening with technology. And I do think being in the midst of this global pandemic has shown us a multitude of things, one of which is just what happens when we're thrust into this digital world at an accelerated pace much quicker than we thought we might have to. So there's a lot in there, but looking to our past can help us understand why and how we resisted certain tools, how we've assimilated them into our lives. And also, of course, one of the main core themes of the book is the idea is that technology and tools are coming. They will always be here and be invented. But how can we go deeper and not just disrupt an industry, but disrupt it for the better and create tools that can inure to all of us as opposed to just a select few?
And you say quite rightly that technology may change, but we haven't changed as humans through time. And you've got loads of really good, well-crafted, curated, relevant quotes through the book, which back up what you say. You quote Norman Cousins when you say, history is a vast early warning system. And when we look back through history at what humans have done and how they've behaved, you see, don't you, a fatal flaw that we can't help ourselves. We can't help but use technology against other cultures, against ourselves, basically, against other tribes and ways of life, because we're Darwinian. We want to survive and conquer the world. Is that what you see on your travels?
Indeed, what a complex and great and important question. And I think that the merging of technologies with who we are is a really, really complicated question. And I think that what I always say is that there's so many things we don't have answers for. And there's very much an obsession with forecasting what's going to happen and trying to predict the future. Inevitably, some of us will be right and some of us will be wrong. But what I know for sure is that one of the ways that we can start to build tools that can protect the common good and bring out the best of our humanity is to have more people at the table. So as you know, I talk about diversity, inclusion, representation in the book. And I think that inevitably, we've seen throughout history that technological tools have been used for good, and they've also, of course, been used for evil. And so as we look into the future and potentially to tools that are going to be exponentially smarter than we are or could ever be, having a more inclusive view of humanity, widening that circle of humanity, as Albert Schweitzer would say, you know, to create more room for more of us to benefit is going to be so essential, because inevitably we see that these tools will be built, and when they're built in silos and by a very elite homogenous few, inevitably they're going to reflect the biases and prejudices, conscious and unconscious, of that group of people. And we've seen patterns throughout history, which is why history can also teach us about ways we might move forward, or what we've done with chemical weapons bans, or the horrifying prospect of nuclear annihilation. And I think that some of these ideas will help lead us into the future, but we're also going to need new laws and new ideas, and to really reimagine who we are as a society if we want to build a brighter future for the generations that will come after us.
Let's talk about technology then briefly, close to both our hearts, the book, the most the most efficient machine ever invented to transfer complex ideas and insights between brains through space and time. How relevant, though, is that amazing technology, the technology of the book, to the future of AI? Surely the days are numbered for the book.
Oh, yes. And so, of course, as you said, we are both book lovers. And indeed, my book is a book lover's book. And chapter 9 will be for you if you love books, because I think and talk a lot about storytelling and this idea of books. And as you said, this incredible, magical thing, I think it was Stephen King who said, it's the most portable type of magic. And I think that, you know, I am someone that loves the idea that we can have ebooks at our fingertips, but at the same time, browsing through libraries or independent bookstores and looking at books, to me, really is, we have this vast treasure trove of a record of who we are as a human civilization. And so I think that there is, and it's only natural, to have a deep fear of what AI is going to take from us. And part of why I think AI is such an interesting, difficult topic is that for the first time, suddenly we're wondering if we're still going to be at the top of the food chain. And this is why AI in particular strikes people in a really a fearful way. And it's, of course, why we have the AI effect. When we connect with AI in our daily lives, like Netflix or Google algorithms, suddenly we don't even want to call it intelligent anymore, because I think that we start to feel like it's on our turf. And my book is rather radical in suggesting that we actually can learn to embrace and thrive in a world where we're okay with not being at the center. I even suggest moving away from a human-centric view of how we look at human civilization. And suddenly, when we aren't at the top of the food chain anymore, we can actually open ourselves up for whole new worlds. I think that some people say that AI could never take over things like creativity. AI is very bad at things like common sense. And that may or may not be true, but the question I want to ask is, What are we afraid of when we're saying something else might be creative or smart? And I think that what's so important is to remember that there can be room for all of us. There can be books in libraries, and there can also be these incredible technological tools. And I think there's room in our world to embrace all of that, as opposed to having a scarcity mentality, saying it either has to be this or it has to be that. The answer is that there really is room for all of that. And if we can learn to partner with these technologies, we can actually reimagine our societies and our worlds into ways that we haven't even thought of yet. And what might we do, for example, if AI can help us read through all the medical journals and all the cures and treatments that a human doctor could never get through? What might that look like for compassionate patient care and spending more time with each other in the material world if we allow these tools to help us connect even more?
The fear seems to be about our redundancy, doesn't it? And on the work front, do you agree with Yuval Harari when he says that the AI revolution will create a useless class of people in society?
Yes.
And I assume he means that in a pejorative way. You say we'll be judged less by what we do and more by who we are. What do you mean by that? I mean, it seems, on the one hand, we've got opening up of a possibility to do things and pursue our dreams and hobbies and have lots of time on our hands, because maybe we'll get a universal basic income. And on the other hand, our sense of purpose is taken away from us. Our position in the world is taken away from us. Our status is taken away from us.
Indeed, yes. That useless morass of people that is discussed. I think that that is a real danger. And again, as a human rights lawyer, someone who has studied economics and inequality and social justice, I think that that lens is so important, which is part of why I wrote the book, to bring the human approach to how we might deal with these issues. Because I think so much of this, the discussion happens in a very siloed way, where there's only an elite group of people allowed into the room to discuss these tools. And they really need to be discussed alongside reimagining, as of course I write in the book, reimagining our politics, our economics, our educational systems, our societal systems. And so I think that it's only natural to be afraid. I'm afraid of things every day, all day. There is so much to be afraid of. And I don't think we'll ever get to a place where we won't be afraid. But part of why I wrote the book is that none of these beneficial possibilities for technology are going to be possible without a reimagining of the systems in which they are created. So if people are creating tools, technologies such as AI within this specific profit-focused capitalist system, of course, it's only going to be about quarterly reports and what is going to make a profit in that very short-term timeframe. And yes, their automation has been coming, and it has been coming for a long time. And of course, first it was manual labor, and now it's coming for knowledge workers and for types of work that has never been automated before, but that's happening very fast. We don't exactly know how fast that's going to be. Some estimates say between 30 and 50% of the workforce in the next few years. Some people say it'll just be parts of jobs, not full jobs, but we do know that we have been working in partnership with our machines. And before that, we were working in partnership, for example, with horses and other things for a very, very long time. And so that is a real possibility. But it's always been the case that industries are evolving and changing. There's plenty of examples of different types of new technologies taking over old forms of work. And it's only natural to be afraid. And so what comes with this profound responsibility alongside building new technologies needs to be training people for new types of jobs, educational systems, social systems, where people are kind of endowed with that agency and autonomy to be building new futures for themselves, their families, and the next generations. So it's very easy to say, oh, just get used to a new tool, but we have to be creating societal systems where we all can benefit from those tools. And I do think that that fear of being without purpose is so, so real. But if we look at it a different way, it can be a way to actually dive into our purpose and our creativity and our meaning in really, really valuable ways. But we have to be creating the structures, and we have to have the moral courage and the ethical leadership to bring people along into this new world so people don't feel left behind. Because when people feel left behind, horrible, horrible things happen.
Let's talk about leadership. Yeah, horrible things do happen when horrible people are in charge. And there are various thought experiments in the book, great ones that you refer to and highlight, like Nick Bostrom's Mankind Destroying Paperclip Robots. And you describe an ethical knob in a car that can be pressed and to take you various places with different consequences. Where do you think the unethical knobs running our countries are taking us?
Oh, my students, I teach a class on ethical decisions and leadership, and my students too love debating and discussing these questions, which of course are very ancient philosophical tools and thought experiments, but they've taken on new meaning. I think that everything, when we talk about building new economies, new tools, a new approach to building a workforce that is prepared for the technologies of tomorrow, it all comes back to ethical leadership. There is so much that we can't predict, that we can't forecast, and that we can't change. But one thing that we can do is have more people in the room, more diverse voices, more inclusive representation of the array, the spectrum of the brilliance of humanity. And so many of the things that we're talking about are very difficult, complicated issues that aren't easily going to be fixed. But we must have more radical inclusion and diversity, because what we see is that when leadership is not working with the moral compass at the center, and for me, one of the things I always say, and I say it throughout the book, is that there is deep, deep, deep danger in saying, I'm the one that can fix your problems. I will do it. Just trust me. And no one of us has all the answers. So a big red flag is when someone starts to say, whether it's a tech company or whether it's anyone in local, federal, global leadership, says, I'm the one that has the answers. I'm, for example, reading a lot of Masha Gessen's work right now, The Future is History, for example, and you start to see that there are these insidious threats and dangers that start to happen when people start to hoard power as opposed to using it to build a brighter world. I think there's a very kind of serious danger when someone says they have all the answers. Because one of the things I found in my work is that one of the only things we know is that no one of us has all the answers. We have to be able to work across industries and silos to say, this isn't my lived experience. I could never understand what you're going through. Can you help me understand this? And we're seeing right now, of course, the pandemic and beyond, what happens when we don't have that sense of ethical leadership at the core, then everything that comes from that is toxic. And we're starting to see the fabric of society that has been ripping for a very long time starts to tear, and those wounds will be opened until we start to face them and make room for all of us for equity and for justice.
Yeah, you talk about the need for collective intelligence and diversity in the development of AI, every level, and the pandemic is exposing sort of monotheistic or, you know, binary approaches to black and white, literally, and decision making. And when we're faced with an existential threat like COVID-19, we are exposed to all different outcomes and solutions, and science that has been brought to the fore, hasn't it? And we're learning that there is a philosophy to science where you have to approach things in a problem-solving manner in order to make progress. No one has all the answers, and it's very humbling for the human race at the moment to be faced with this existential threat. How do we build diversity and collective intelligence into our organizations when the very organizations that are leading the charge on AI aren't diverse themselves, when shareholder value rather than collective values are turning the ethical knobs on the machines?
Of course, and it's an incredibly important question, which is why in Chapter 7 and beyond, I wanted to have this discussion and put forth some ideas, some frameworks, some ways about our economics and our politics and our societal institutions in new ways. Because again, the technology in a vacuum is not going to help us solve the deeper societal issues and get to the root of the inequality and the injustice that seeps through everything that we do if we don't face that. So of course, in the book, I propose a lot of different ideas, one of which is to use our international human rights framework as it, albeit imperfect, but I think one of our world's best frameworks to date in terms of starting with the idea that we are all equally and intrinsically valuable, and creating our laws and policies and institutions and teams around that idea, so that we are working towards a place where we are more radically inclusive and more representative of all the lived experiences that no one person could ever have. And I think that one of the things to think about if we take a step back is even some of the larger tech companies had no idea that they would be in this situation. There's a very complicated, complex, you know, layering of things that needs to happen for any one historical event, you know, for the Tinders to finally spark fire. And so I think that one of the things to think about is that there's so many things we can't solve for, but when we're able to have more lived experiences and to say that sameness is not equal to worthiness or value. And when we start to realize that there is such brilliance and power in having that inclusivity, and that it's not just a great idea for justice, it's a great idea for building new tools, then we start to realize, for example, you mentioned one of the things I talked about in the book that has also, of course, taken the world stage, is this idea of universal basic income. And the idea is, what would happen if we decoupled our worth and our value from whether we have a job at any one point. The studies show that people, when they're able to put food on the table, they're not lazier, they're more entrepreneurial and creative than ever. Because when people feel like they matter, they can do extraordinary things. The right to housing has been established as a right in Finland, for example, meaning you get a house no matter if you're on or off drugs, whether or not you have a job. And guess what happens when people feel like they matter enough to have a roof over their heads, regardless of where they are in that particular moment? They, of course, get jobs, they get off drugs, they start to realize that society is valuing them as human beings. I, of course, expand that beyond human beings and suggest that looking at our environmental situation and treating all living things with respect and dignity, regardless of what happens, actually can make us better people in the process. And I think so much of what I write about and what we've been seeing in the world stage is that treating each other better helps us be better people no matter what is coming next.
Do you think we're getting close to, maybe in the light of, or maybe because of the pandemic, a kind of universal bill of human rights? And I know such human rights exist in form through the UN, but do you think that nations outside of the scope of, say, Western civilization and democracies, everybody can be brought together now in a new version of human rights that includes standards of living and education and technology and access to technology, just because we're all facing the same threat?
I think that this is an essential question of our times. Of course, everything from climate ecological disaster to the threat of nuclear annihilation to things like AI to, of course, the global pandemic starts to show kind of the critical core idea of my book and, you know, of a way of thinking about things, which is that we're all deeply interconnected. We are intrinsically related. There's, you know, I think it was John Muir who said, when you pull a string at anything, you find that everything in the universe is all connected. And I do think a pandemic, of course, shows us these deep wounds in society, that the key to being a just, equitable place is you treat the most marginalized and the most vulnerable, you bring them to the center. And then protecting their health and their rights and their dignity, ultimately, you're protecting a better future for us all. And the idea is to build a brighter future that we might never see, but that the next generations might see. So yes, I mean, that is, of course, my hope, that we can see each other as that interconnected community. And having lived and had conversations with people all around the world, that is not opposite to, it goes hand in hand with celebrating the spectrum of our diversity. And of course, another theme of the book is there is no binary. There is a spectrum of humanity, and embracing all of that is critical. However, with things like the pandemic, for example, we are also seeing a deep receding and fear that is resulting in threats of authoritarianism, autocracy, totalitarianism, and that threat of closing down borders and closing down others, because that physical closing down of borders that has to happen in a deeply interconnected world when there's a pandemic, of course, is also an opportunity for opportunists to say, we need to be nationalist first, we need to only take care of ourselves. And that that fear is manipulated. And propaganda is as old as human history, but technology has been able to spread it so fast. So conspiracy theories and hate and anger spread like wildfire. So to me, this is one of the biggest dangers of the society we're living in now, is that we are in very, very serious danger of living in separate truths, where we no longer have a goalpost, an axis around which we can all rally. We have the ability, through a lot of different technological tools and platforms we have now, to really reside in our own truths and in our own filter bubbles. And we have to be reaching across divides and building bridges instead of walls.
That's right. And you say that empathy is the core to our humanity, but over-empathizing with people like us, our nation, our people, are say of the same race or the same job, leads to tribalism and war, and algorithms seem to reinforce this tribalism. And I think that's the argument at the core of the book, is that if we have to put humans and humanity and humanism at the heart of that algorithm, right? Otherwise, we're going to end up being divided into more tribes because of the very empathy which pulls us together.
Yes, I've done a lot of research on empathy, as have many others, and I speak of empathy and compassion as critical components alongside trust, fairness, equity, and justice. And yes, there is some research, of course, as you exactly just said, when you over-empathize with one group, then that can separate you from empathizing with the whole. But I think that true definition of compassion, stepping inside the suffering of another, or empathy, really, really seeing the suffering and the pain and the experiences of another, I think is actually critical, because that true definition means that we can celebrate our diversity, but at the same time, we recognize again that sameness does not equate to value. Just because someone thinks or is different from you in some way, we have to start with a baseline that we are all intrinsically valuable. And then from there can spring all the policies, regulations, laws, and ideas that we need. And the cool thing about empathy, like creativity, is it's actually a learned trait. We can learn so much, I think, in so many different ways from children and how children act and how children move in the world. And we watch, and slowly but surely, of course, all of us learn to close off and to put on our armor and to protect ourselves and to only focus on ourselves because it's only natural and there's only so much we can do in a day or a lifetime. But what would the world look like if there was no such thing as someone else's child? And if we treated the other as oneself, and if we realized how deeply connected we were, and if we wore a mask to protect others, not just ourselves, and we recognized that, you know, that hurting another is hurting oneself, how might we be able to shift? And it's not an easy thing to do. It takes a lifetime to start to recognize and strip away all the things that separate us. And there's no such thing as an unbiased, unprejudiced human being. We are trained with those things from day one, and it's also built into our biomechanics to immediately categorize, okay, this person is safe, or this is a woolly mammoth that's coming at me. So my brain has to immediately categorize. And our brains have limits. The brain is actually so deeply unknown in so many ways. So it's not really about moving past any of that. It's being aware of it and being willing to face all the incredibly majestic and the flawed parts of ourselves. And I think that's where we start what David White calls those courageous conversations about how we move forward ever imperfectly, how we stumble along, but how we do it together. In one of the words that I and you use too, collectively. I think individually we can feel so small, but together there's really no star we can't dream of exploring.
And as Walt Whitman said, you know, maybe the machines are just another multitude that we're about to become. Flynn, thank you so much. I'm glad the technology of the book has brought us together today, and the technology of video communications and audio communications. Thank you for sharing your OMI with Bookomi today.
Oh, the honor and pleasure was all mine. Thank you so much for having me.
Flynn's book, A Human Algorithm, How Artificial Intelligence is Defining Who We Are, is available now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. If you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bookomi.com. Bookomi members can register to take part in our podcast recordings, and getting the email will tell you who we've got coming up. Meanwhile, if you've enjoyed this Bookomi podcast, which I'm sure you have because it was with Flynn Coleman, please reveal your feelings by liking, following, or subscribing on Apple, Spotify, and Google audio platforms, or any other platform, as many do exist. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Learn from the past, live in the present, and imagine the future together. Bye for now. I love Bookomi.